The revelation that the blighter Pilbeam had seen him putting the stolen pig in Baxter's caravan induced in Hugo Carbody a sort of mental coma. But soon he realized that this ghastly snag was too big for any man to tackle. It called for a woman's keener wit. His first act, therefore, was to leave the drawing-room and totter downstairs to the telephone. He got the number of Matchingham Hall, and establishing communication with Sir Gregory Parslow Parslow's butler, urged him to summon Miss Millicent Threepwood from the dinner table. The butler said, in rather a reproving way, that Miss Threepwood was at the moment busy drinking soup. Hugo replied that he didn't care if she was bathing in it. "Fetch her," said Hugo. He then clung weakly to the receiver, waiting, and in a short while a sweet but agitated voice floated to him across the wire. "Hugo?
Millicent?
Is that you?"
"Yes, is that you?"
"Yes." Anything in the nature of a misunderstanding was cleared away. It was both of them. "What's up?"
"Everything's up."
"How do you mean?"
"I'll tell you," said Hugo, and did so.
"Oh, golly," said Millicent. Silence followed. Hugo waited palpitatingly. He wondered if he placed too much reliance in woman's wit. That golly had not been hopeful. "That's a bit thick."
"Yes," agreed Hugo. The thickness of it had not escaped him.
"Well, there's only one thing to do." A faint thrill passed through Hugo Carmody. Woman's wit was going to bring home the bacon after all. The only thing to do is for me to go back to the dining room and tell Uncle Clarence you've found the Empress."
"Well, how do you mean?"
"But Pilbeam saw us putting her there."
"I know."
"Well, what's our move when he says so?" "Stout denial."
"Eh?"
"We stoutly deny it," said Millicent. "Now, hold on. I'll go and tell Uncle Clarence. I'll expect he'll be out in a moment to have a word with you." Hugo resumed his vigil. It was some moments later that a noise like the clucking of fowls broke out at the Matchingham Hall end of the wire.
"Cuck, cuck, cuck."
"Yes, Lord Emsworth."
"Cuck, Carmody."
"Yes, Lord Emsworth."
"Is this true?"
"Yes, Lord Emsworth."
"You found the Empress?"
"Yes, Lord Emsworth."
"In that fella Baxter's caravan?"
"Yes, Lord Emsworth."
"Well, I'll be damned."
"Yes, Lord Emsworth." So far, Hugo Carmody had found his share of the dialogue delightfully easy, but there was something else besides "yes, Lord Emsworth" that he must now endeavour to say. He swallowed twice to unlimber his vocal cords. "Lord Emsworth," he said, "there is something I would like to take this opportunity of saying. It will come as a surprise to you, but I hope not as an unpleasant surprise. I love your niece Millicent, and she loves me, Lord Emsworth. We have loved each other for many weeks, and it is my hope that you will give your consent to our marriage." There was dead silence at the other end of the wire. It was only some moments later, after he had said hello 6 times, that Hugo's natural chagrin was sensibly diminished by the sudden sound of Millicent's voice in his ear.
"Hello? Hello. I say, Hugo, things are hotting up here properly. I sprung it on Uncle Clarence just now that I wanted to marry you."
"So did I, only he wasn't there."
"I said, Uncle Clarence, aren't you grateful to Mr. Carmody for finding the Empress?" And he said, "Yes, yes, 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 to be sure. Capital boy, capital boy. Always liked him." And I said, "I suppose you wouldn't by any chance let me marry him." And he said, "Eh, what, marry him?" "Yes," I said, "marry him." And he said, "Certainly, certainly, 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 by all means." And then Aunt Constance had a fit, and Uncle Galley said she was a killjoy and ought to be ashamed of herself for throwing the gaff into love's young dream. And Uncle Clarence kept on saying, "Certainly, certainly, certainly. I'm going back to see how it's all coming out. Hold the line." Hugo sat tense and breathless, like one listening in on the radio to a championship fight in which he has a financial interest. It was only when a cheery voice spoke at his elbow that he realized that his solitude had been invaded, and by Percy Pilbeam at that. Percy Pilbeam was looking rosy and replete. He swayed slightly.
"Hello, Carmody," said Percy Pilbeam. "What ho, Carmody. So here you are, Carmody."
It came to Hugo that he had something to say to this man.
"Here, you."
"Yes, Carmody."
"Do you want to be battered to a pulp?"
"No, Carmody."
"Then listen. You didn't see me put that pig in the caravan, understand?"
"But I did, Carmody."
"You didn't. Not if you want to go on living."
"Say no more, Carmody. I take your point. You want me not to tell anybody I saw you put that caravan in the pig?"
"Quite, Carmody. Carmody, quite. Well, bear it in mind."
"I will, Carmody."
"Oh, yes, Carmody, I will.
I'm going for a stroll outside, Carmody. Care to join me?"
"Go to hell."
"Quite,"
said Percy Pilbeam. He tacked unsteadily to the door, aimed himself at it, and passed through. and a moment later Millicent's voice spoke. "Hugo! Hello! Oh, Hugo, darling, the battle's over. We won! Uncle Clarence has said certainly 65 times, and he's just told Aunt Constance that if she thinks she can bully him, she's very much mistaken. It's a walkover! They're all coming back right away in the car. I'm going to give them the slip and walk home along the road. Get out Ronnie's two-seater and come and pick me up, and we'll go for a drive together. It's the most perfect evening." "You bet it is," said Hugo fervently. "Atta boy," said Millicent. "Atta baby," said Hugo. Oblivious of the fact that the efficient Baxter was hiding under the bed, Sue stood staring wide-eyed at Ronnie Fish. "Ronnie!" cried Sue. It was all she had time to say. The thought of what she had done for his sake, the thought that for love of him she had come to Blandings Castle under false colours, an impostor, faced at every turn by the risk of detection, the thought of the shameful way he'd treated her, all these thoughts were racking Ronald Fish with a searing anguish. They'd brought the hot blood of the fishes to the boil, and now, face to face with her, he did not hesitate. He sprang forward, clasped her in his arms, hugged her to him. To Baxter's revolted ears there came in a husky cataract the sound of a fish's self-reproaches. Ronnie was saying what he thought of himself, and his opinion appeared not to be high. He revealed himself as a blister, a tick, and a perishing outsider. "You're not. I am. You're not. I am. Of course you're not. I certainly am. Well, I love you anyway. You can't. I do. You can't. I do." Baxter writhed in silent anguish. "How long," said Baxter to his immortal soul, "how long?" The question was answered with a startling promptitude. From the neighbourhood of the French windows there sounded a discreet cough.
"Your manuscript, miss," said Beach sedately.
Sue looked at him. Ronnie looked at him. Neither seemed very glad to see him. Ronnie was the first to speak. "So there you are, Beach."
"Yes, sir."
"I suppose all this must seem tolerably rummy to you."
"No, sir."
"Beach, how much do you know?"
"All, sir."
"All?"
"Yes, sir."
"Such as some..." Beach coughed.
"I am aware that this lady is a Miss Sue Brown, and according to my informant, she is employed in the chorus of the Regal Theatre."
"Quite the encyclopedia, aren't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"I want to marry Miss Brown, Beach."
"I can readily appreciate such a desire on your part, Mr. Ronald," said the butler with a paternal smile.
Sue caught at the smile. "Ronnie, he's all right. He isn't going to give us away."
"Me, miss?" said Beach, shocked. "Certainly not."
"Splendid fellow, Beach."
"Thank you, sir."
"Beach," said Ronnie, "the time has come to act. I've got to make myself solid with Uncle Clarence at once. Directly he gets back tonight, I shall go to him and tell him that Empress of Blandings is in the gamekeeper's cottage in the West Wood. And then, while he's still weak, I shall spring on him the announcement of my engagement."
"Unfortunately, Mr. Ronald, the animal is no longer in the cottage."
"You've moved it?"
"Not I, sir. Mr. Carmody. By a most regrettable chance, Mr. Carmody found me feeding it this afternoon. He took it away and deposited it in some place of which I am not cognizant, sir."
"But good heavens, he'll dish the whole scheme. Go at once and ask him where that pig is. Tell him it's vital."
"Very good, sir."
Sue had listened with bewilderment to this talk of pigs. "I don't understand, Ronnie. Look, I can't explain now, it's too long, but I can tell you this. If we don't get that pig back, we're in the soup. Ronnie!" Ronnie had ceased to pace the room. He was standing in a listening attitude. "What's that?" He sprang quickly to the balcony, looked over the parapet, and came softly back. "Sue! What?" "It's that blighter Pilbeam," said Ronnie in a guarded undertone. "He's climbing up the waterspout."
The 9th Earl of Emsworth was not a man who was easily disturbed. But no matter how placid you may be, if you find yourself in close juxtaposition with a man who, when he is not hurling himself out of windows, is stealing pigs and trying to make you believe that they were stolen by your butler, you begin to think of it. Lord Emsworth was thoroughly upset. As the car bowled up the drive, he was saying to himself that nothing could surprise him now. And yet, something did. As the car turned the corner by the rhododendrons and wheeled into the broad strip of gravel that faced the front door, he beheld a sight which brought the first sound he had uttered since the journey began, bursting from his lips.
"Good God! What is the matter?"
said Lady Constance.
"Matter? Look! Look at that fellow climbing the waterspout."
"What? Where? I don't see him."
"He's just got into the balcony outside one of the bedrooms,"
said the Hon. Galahad. Lord Emsworth went straight to the heart of the matter.
"It's that fellow Baxter!"
There were, he knew, on the premises of Blandings Castle, other male adults besides Rupert Baxter, but none of these would climb up waterspouts and disappear over balconies. To Baxter, on the other hand, such a pursuit would seem the normal, ordinary way of passing an evening. Soon, no doubt, he would come out onto the balcony again and throw himself to the ground. That was the sort of fellow Baxter was, a man of strange pleasures.
The car had drawn up now outside the front door, and the ninth Earl, accompanied by his brother Galahad, hurried up the steps and entered the hall. As they did so, there came to their ears the sound of running feet. The next moment, the flying figure of Percy Bilbeam came into view, taking the stairs four at a time.
"God bless me soul," said Lord Emsworth.
Pilbeam shot through the hall, and more like a startled gazelle than a private inquiry agent, vanished down the steps. His shirt front was dark with dirt stains, and it seemed to Lord Emsworth that he had a black eye. The next instant, there descended the stairs and flitted past with equal speed the form of Ronnie Fish. Lord Emsworth got an entirely wrong conception of the affair. He had no means of knowing what had taken place in the garden room when Pilbeam, inspired by alcohol and flushed with the thought that now was the time to get into that apartment and possess himself of the manuscript of the Honourable Galahad's reminiscences, had climbed the waterspout to put the plan into operation. He knew nothing of the detective's sharp dismay at finding himself unexpectedly confronted with the menacing form of Ronnie Fish. He was ignorant of the lively and promising mix-up which had been concluded by Pilbeam's tempestuous dash for life. All he saw was two men fleeing madly for the open spaces, and he placed the obvious interpretation upon this phenomenon. Baxter, he assumed, had run amok, and had done it with such uncompromising thoroughness that strong men ran panic-stricken before him. The Honourable Galahad, who had turned to watch the procession through the front door with a surprised monocle, turned back and found that he was alone. Lord Emsworth had disappeared. He now beheld him coming back. On his amiable face was the look of determination. In his hand was a gun.
"Hey, what?"
said the On Galahad, blinking. The head of the family did not reply. He was moving towards the stairs. A sound as of disturbed hens made the Honourable Galahad turn again.
"Galahad! What is all this? What is happening?"
The Honourable Galahad placed his sister in possession of the facts as known to himself.
"Clarence has just gone upstairs with a gun."
"With a gun?"
"Yes. Looked like mine, too. Hope he takes care of it."
He perceived that Lady Constance has also been seized with the urge to climb. So nimbly did she move that she was on the second landing before he came up with her. And as they stood there, a voice made itself heard from a room down the corridor.
"Baxter! Come out! Come out, Baxter, my dear fellow, immediately!"
In the race for the room from which the words had appeared to proceed, Lady Constance, getting off to a good start, beat her brother by a matter of two lengths. She was thus the first to see a sight unusual, even at Blandings Castle. Her young guest, Miss Schoonmaker, was standing by the window, looking excited and alarmed. Her brother Clarence, pointing a gun expertly from the hip, was staring fixedly at the bed. And from under the bed, a little like a tortoise protruding from its shell, there was coming into view the spectacled head of the efficient Baxter.